yes, I remember that.
So, good morning, everyone, and welcome, or welcome back, as the case might be, to the second Harvard Forum on ICTs and Human Development. Many of us were here about 6 years ago when we talked about the potential that ICTs had on various aspects of what might be broadly called the human condition and society. Since then, a lot has changed, and so the purpose of this gathering is to assess what it is that might have changed and how, and in the process also think about what the things that remain to be done are and what additional thinking needs to be, and hopefully close that gap from what we know we don't know and what we don't know we don't know, as the case might be. The game plan for the opening session is fairly straightforward. My name is Rohinton Medora. I'm the Vice President for Programs at IDRC. We will ask the three principles in many ways on the thinking and the conception of the issue to lead off, David Malone, Amartya Sen, and Michael Spence. And it's usually a sort of cliche where you go, these three speakers need no introduction, and then one goes on to introduce them. But I'm genuinely not going to do that, because they genuinely don't need an introduction. But also because we want to keep this as a conversation throughout the day and a half. So following the sort of opening remarks from the three, Randy Spence, who's been principal and a pillar in the organization and thinking on much of this, will give us a sense of how the day and a half will unfold, and in the process, summarize for us the contributions that many of you have made to motivate the discussion. And we will then get reaction from Michael and Yohai Benkler, following which the floor will be open for comment. And somewhere in there, perhaps after the welcome remarks, I think most of us know most of us, but not everyone knows everyone, so I'd like to very quickly go around the table and ask you to simply identify yourself and where you're from, because we've read the biographies, but we need to connect the name with the face. So with those few thoughts, David, over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Rohinton. It's a thrill to be back here, actually. I studied here about 25 years ago, and this is only the second time I've been back to Harvard since then. So that's great. It's a great privilege to be here with all of you and with Mike and Amartya. Mike's done a tremendous amount to encourage IDRC in its work, and we're very grateful for that. And Amartya has also, over the years, done a tremendous amount to support and encourage us. IDRC has to be the least well-known funder of development effort of any sort anywhere in the world. That doesn't actually bother us. We like to be known through the work of those we're privileged to support. And that is the ethos. Our first president, who I think Martia must have known well, David Hopper, set, and we've remained true to it. For me, coming to IDRC late after representing my country in India recently, what's been very exciting is to see how quickly fields of inquiry and economic activity can develop. And the ultimate example, I think, is ICTs nowadays. And I think there was a temptation early on to think, ICTs are going to solve many problems. And they have, of course, addressed a number of gaps, but as the excellent paper of comments by all of you that was put together prior to the conference makes clear, in so doing, many new challenges have been raised, and I think we'll be discussing those today. I'm very grateful to the Berkman Center for the wonderful work they've done putting this together. It's been terrific for IDRC to work with such partners over the years. And of course, I'm grateful to my own colleagues who have worked very hard on this, and to a former colleague, Randy Spence, who has worked very hard on it also. One final word. When I was in my first days in India representing my country, Amartya came to India, as he does all the time, and came to Delhi, and I followed him round for a day. At first, I think he found it very pesky, but he got used to it. And it was the most fascinating day, because as a result of doing so, I met all sorts of people from strata of society and types of organizations I would not have met otherwise. And it was the beginning, really, of an engagement with India beyond official India, which is what gave me the greatest pleasure during my stay there. So many thanks to you all for coming. Many of you have traveled long distances to be with us. And for me, today is going to be a fantastic learning process. Thank you, Rohinton.
Thanks, David. Amartya, any words at this point?
Well, first of all, to say how delighted I am and all of us are to be here in this meeting arranged with great care by Randy. I think I remember David's stay in India very well indeed, and he was a fantastic presence in Delhi. I've been thinking what we can do to make him feel more at home in his old alma mater, Harvard, and I think we have to raise the temperature as close to Delhi as possible later in the day. That's just about the only thing we can do at the moment. But it was wonderful the way David got involved in Indian society and the really challenging aspects of the Indian society. Dave Hopper, who was the founder, I didn't know he was the founder, I did know that he was there earlier. I first encountered him also in Delhi in 63. It was 63. He was part of the Ford Foundation then, I think. And I remember his calling me one morning. You see, at that time, we had just started the economics department, well, not started, but reshaping the economics department, which will become quite fairly well established soon. But we were technically very unequipped, and I had mentioned that at a dinner to David. And one morning, David Hopper called me and saying, Amartya, would you like to have an IBM 1620? So I didn't quite know what he was talking about. And I didn't know whether it was meant for me, like a little present that I will have on my desk. So I asked him, how large is it? And he said, well, you need a couple of rooms for it. It became quite clear that it was an invitation for the Delhi School of Economics to do something, which we did. And actually it played. It was a very primitive computer in present terms, but it made a major difference to the fact that our students got used to it and something which many of my students loved. They were quite mathematically sophisticated, but they hadn't run into any technology before. And they said, I'm always afraid of making a great fool of myself. What I would love to do is to sit around with one of these computers where I can make as many mistakes and then learn from them. And this was certainly this opportunity, because it's open 24 hours a day. You can go in any time and work on that. So, we had a long connection with the whole family, if I may put through David Hopper, that old connection, and of course David Malone himself very much. I think David underestimates when he says that it's the least well-known of the supporters. I think what is important, and I think for this meeting too, is to recognize why it is so well-known. It's very well-known in some quarters, and maybe there are some other quarters where it's not. I think the first thing is to recognize that it has been able to provide support for less mainstream things, less standard things, which naturally gets attention and get more easily the front page of the newspapers, including the New York Times. And so I think that has been a feature. I don't want to go into that very much. There will be an opportunity to come back to it when we have substantive discussion. And the other thing has been that it has been willing to ask very difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And indeed, we have some now dealing with the information technology, like issues of privacy and control and democracy and how it affects things, whether it subverts it, supports it. I want to raise a question about what it does to schooling and literacy, to what extent info technology tend to be a kind of substitute for getting to school. And it's very important because All our studies indicate that what you get from school is not just what you learn, the 3 hours, but you also get together with others, get out of the family. Anything that keeps you at home in front of a box rather than with the children of many other families where the families don't share the prejudices that your family had, and you can bring to them also counter to prejudices that their families have. And that's one of the things, one of my earlier PhD students in Delhi, at the same time, I think, in 60s, was called a chap called Dipi Chaudhary. And one of the odd things he found quite startling results about the impact of education. One of them was that even when the schools were pretty rotten, it had a noticeable impact on performance. So there's something happening which is other than the success of the grammar teacher in the school. So I think there are many difficult questions here, and I think IDC, the RT, has been a leader of the world in bringing them to fore and providing systematic critique of them. And this is one of the fields in which it's particularly needed, I think, what we're going to discuss today. So I think I'll just leave that and really welcome you all to Harvard. I may be one of the few really Harvard persons here. Mike hired me at one stage when he was dean. And from time to time when there's some problems, I said, but in his letter to me, Mike Spence, in 1986, November, said. And so there's all these letters. But since Mike has moved away, and many others have moved away, and David has moved away, and rarely comes here, and so much for alumni relations that you've been here only twice since then. Let me welcome you to Harvard.
Thank you. Mike, over to you.
Yeah, I love coming back here. It's changed a lot. I mean, even this faculty club has a beautiful garden. It used to be a parking lot. The breakfast room used to be a kind of scruffy patio. This is quite fun to be here. Let me just try to be brief. I'm probably going to say some generally stupid things in the course of the next day and a half, so I want to explain in advance that Randy and I are unrelated to each other. I think I came again because I enjoyed the last meeting tremendously, and I expect to learn a great deal from those of you who have been engaged in sort of research and trying to influence policy in this very important area. So, and I'm thrilled to be included. Let me just say a couple of things about what I've been doing since the last meeting that have influenced my thinking a great deal. I chaired a commission on growth and development, which consisted of sort of very senior political and policy leaders, mostly in the developing world. And we wrote a report that a young man named Simon Cox, who is at The Economist, a brilliant writer and economist, actually, managed to make readable after my first draft. And we're in the process. We're within about 3 or 4 days of releasing a special report on what the crisis means in multiple dimensions for the developing world as you look out into the future. So what I wanted to say, just by way of the start, and to explain why I'm so interested in learning from all of you, is that it became clear to me in the course of working with these people, most of whom had struggled with varying degrees of success to, you know, develop, reduce poverty, and so on, that there were two critical sort of inputs that enabled the kind of extraordinarily high sustained growth that we've seen in some parts of the developing world. Transformational growth, 7 to 10%, you know, poverty reduction at astonishing rates. Not everywhere, but now including something on the order of, prospectively, of 3.5 billion people, which is a non-trivial achievement. And those two critical inputs were, one, sort of political leadership in establishing a form of governance of an inclusive kind that enabled this process to start. a kind of corollary of that is that while there's an ongoing debate, and Amartya is an important part of it, about what aspects of the way a society is governed or chooses to govern itself are really important for various aspects of growth and development. The one thing that's pretty clear is that the dynamics are a process of entrepreneurship, innovation, bottom-up, changing things, usually in a not in fact always in the case of the known cases, a market-oriented system properly regulated. But the second one, the one I really wanted to emphasize, is that it was the global economy that made this possible. And the global economy may or may not have a bright future, but it supplied two things. The one that economists understand well is a gigantic market in which you can expand almost as fast as you can figure out a way to do it. That one's pretty well understood. The other one, I think, is increasingly well understood and is actually more important, and that is knowledge. I told my brother this morning, I will repeat the story, in the course of the Growth Commission work, I was asked the following unpleasant question. If you had a choice between the following two options, which would you take? One, the destruction of the physical capital of a country, plants, infrastructure, buildings, and whatnot, to a very large extent, but retention of its knowledge. And on the one hand, the destruction of a massive form of amnesia, you know, but the physical infrastructure standing. I didn't hesitate a minute. I said, I'll take the physical infrastructure. Go ahead and wreck it. For the obvious reason, and the point I'm trying to make, is that in a sense, the state of an economy now, not a society, not a political system, is in some sense what it knows how to do. And I think if I sort of look backward and then forward, the thing that interests me most about what this whole meeting is about is that it may transform not only access to useful information, but the process of transferring knowledge. This growth that I talked about a minute ago is called pretty much universally now catch-up growth. And the catching up is in part, you know, the building of all that infrastructure, but the more important part is it's the learning process. And you can do it faster than you can do it standalone because some other people know some useful things and you can learn them from them. And on all the cases I've looked at, India, China, that have gone into this sort of sustained high growth mode are, for a variety of different reasons, places that have somehow found it possible to learn at a very high speed. And I imagine, and that's why I'm so interested in this meeting, that we're in mid-revolution in the acceleration of the speed with which that learning, poorly understood, I might add, learning process. We know a little bit about it. We know it kind of goes with engagement with the global economy. Some of it goes with foreign direct investment inflows. Some of it goes with the activities of IDRC and entities like it who have been in this business longer than most. But the number of words and papers written on the more concrete, you know, aspects of the growth process as compared with the sort of knowledge transfer learning process is still way out of balance in relative to their importance. So that's why I'm here, to listen.
So thank you, David. Amartya. Mike? Let's, if it's okay with you, Michael, start with you. Let's quickly go around the table, introduce ourselves, and then turn it over to Randy.
Thank you, Rahinton. My name is Michael Clark. I'm the director of the ICT4D program at IDRC.
My name is Sabri Saidam. I live in the West Bank. My field of interest is ICT4D, science, innovation, and creativity in technology.
I'm Nancy Spence. I wish I could say I'm not related to Randy, but I am. I've been a gender mainstreaming expert for, I guess, about 20 years, and my particular interest is in ICT as a tool in sort of economic and political literacy for women, particularly in Asia.
I'm Lawrence Liang. I'm from the Alternative Law Forum in Bangalore. and I work on the politics of intellectual property and development.
I'm Hernan Galpin. I'm a professor at the Universidad de San Andrés in Argentina and steering committee, part of the steering committee of DIRCI, which is an ICT research network in Latin America and Caribbean.
My name is Ophelia Mascareñas. I'm in a coordinator of a research project known as PICTURE, which is Poverty and ICTs in Urban and Rural Areas in Eastern Africa, a four-country project.
I'm Ineke Buskens, and I'm a project leader of GRACE, Gender Research in Africa and Arab Countries into ICTs for Empowerment. And my interest is in the interface between empowerment and ICTs and the better world.
Yochai Benkler, Harvard Law School and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society.
Alison Gilward, Research ICT Africa, which is a 20-country African ICT policy and regulation research network.
Yeah, my name is Anita Gurumurthy. I'm from IT for Change, also an NGO in Bangalore, like Lawrence's organization. My interests are in the intersections between information society, social policy, gender, and governance.
I'm Ronaldo Lemos. I'm a professor in Brazil at the Fundação Getúlio Vargas. I direct a center called Center for Technology and Society there, and I've been working with IDRC at a project that is called Open Business Models, which involves a research not only in Brazil, but in Argentina, Colombia, Mexico, and Nigeria.
My name is Michael Best. I'm a professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology with appointments in the School of International Affairs and in the College of Computing. I head the Technologies and International Development Laboratory, and I focus on ICTs for development currently primarily in Africa.
My name is Ethan Zuckerman. I'm a researcher at the Berkman Center focused on citizen and participatory media in the developing world. I'm also here with Global Voices, which is our media partner, and I'll be doing my best to summarize these discussions, bring them online, and also bring in people around the world who are watching our discussions and trying to bring out their voices at the table.
I'm Clotilde Fonseca, director of the Omar Dengo Foundation in Costa Rica. I've been working for 22 years on issues of technology development and education. Our institution leads the National Program of Educational Informatics, which has serviced over 1.5 million children and youth, bringing about major changes in the learning process and also important contributions to the economy. My main interest is education, technology, and development with an emphasis on cognitive development through the use of ICT and creativity and productivity.
Randy Spence. I spent 15 very good years with IDRC. Since then have been working mainly on ICT's innovation, human development.
I'm Rohan Samarajeva from Learn Asia. We work in 11 Asian countries. These days it's a think tank that focuses on ICT infrastructure.
Hi, I'm Bill Melody. I'm currently visiting professor at the Technical University of Denmark. Spend my time on ICT4D issues around the world through the LEARN network.
Great. Thank you. Randy, did you want to pass through?
Thank you. And good morning. I tried to write myself out of this program, but I wasn't quite successful. So... I've been asked to do a couple of things, in starting off. One is to just take a really quick look at the program, and it will be really quick. You've all seen it. We had in mind a kind of approximate flow like this of having some initial perspectives. I will do in a minute a kind of feedback of some of the material that you all provided us in advance. Then moving on to, we called it first salvo, some opening kind of positions, going on to priorities, what we think is important, areas that where we might agree, then some research priorities, and summing up. And I think the organizers would be very happy if you kind of kept that idea in mind, but on the other hand, we're all aware that you're here because you have strong ideas, and so if we if the agenda goes a little bit differently, that's fine. It's a flexible, a very proximate and quite flexible plan. I've also, I think, been asked to be kind of the bad guy during the sessions and try to, you know, keep presentations a little bit short. We've asked people to try to stick to about 10 minutes, and so I'll be doing that. I'll probably just sort of give a little tap at about 8 minutes and 9 minutes, just to remind you where you are. If you want to be shorter than that, nobody will object. and the purpose of that, we're not trying to cut people off. People do have ideas they want to express, but we would like to, as much as possible, to have a discussion, and we'll all have lots of chance to. I think once the discussion gets going, it won't be a problem. Having everybody with lots of chance to express what they want to. Briefly, then I have to try to follow my own advice, which is not to take very much time on this. And I hope somebody will have the hook out at about 9 minutes. So here are a few thoughts about the papers that you provided in advance, and I won't spend a lot of time because I think you all have received all those papers, and some organization, not exactly analysis, but thoughts about them from Matt Smith and Laurent Elder and I. Just a couple of thoughts. What has changed since the last Harvard Forum? And I think everybody in particular emphasized the dramatic increase in mobile phone usage, both ownership and using other people's phones. This has, I think, been most dramatic in the developing world in Asia, where usage rates seem to be up in many countries above 90%. Latin America, I think Hernan would say 60 to two-thirds in many countries. Africa, lower. Some countries, I think Allison said, reaching about 40%, but very fast growth in Africa as well. And while the evidence isn't quite as robust, it does appear that use of mobiles by poor people and by women is not very different than by wealthier people and by men. So there do not seem to be large gaps, gender, either on the gender side or on the kind of digital divide side. Does that mean we can all relax? You know, the budget telecom model is going to bring, along with some public investment and activity, will bring access to everybody over the next few years, and we don't really have to worry about it. And I think what you have said is no, that's would be nice, but it's not the case. There are many concerns. One of them is a kind of retrenchment in the improvement reform of telecom policies. Bill Melody and others have spoken about that. So it seems to be a time when in a sense the realization of the value of these operations has struck the vested interests in many countries, and there is some attempt at monopolizing again. I think it's fair to say that the mobile sort of subsector escaped some of the problems of the wired phone subsector for some period of time, and that may be changing. Another area of concern is that mobile phones may not be the answer. I think Professor Binkler and others have said that that a lot of us, you know, make the assumption that mobile phone access will go on to be access to the internet using smartphones, and that, you know, in the next generation there may be something like near universal access to communication and to the internet through mobile phones. Professor Binkler and others have said souped up smartphones may not be the answer. There are control problems in mobile networks that aren't there so much with fixed networks. It's an area I think we should probably discuss a little bit more, because it seems to be quite important in terms of the prospects for access. It's probably the case that mobile phone infrastructure is much less expensive than the wired, and if there are serious problems with it, that's something that should be clarified. There are other problems. There are problems of the nature of access. Anita and others have written about being not conducive to the best usage of that access. There are problems of other areas of opposition to openness, such as the digital rights movement. And so there seem to be many concerns. And I guess the question I would ask, and some of you have asked, many of you have asked, is what needs to be done? What needs to be done to try to ensure that appropriate access continues to expand in turn, and what needs to be done in terms of policy and regulation, in terms of participatory approaches that Bill wrote about, in terms of community action that people like Ono Purbo have practiced and written about. Moving on to benefits, then, what are the benefits from this access? This, I think, is the other, in some sense, the other big change that I see from the first Harvard Forum, is that there's a much greater focus and more evidence now on what's the potential, what are the benefits, what are some of the downsides. Most of you, I think, have said that the potential benefits are very large, and there is a lot more evidence than 6 years ago about the actual benefits being substantial, if uneven, across populations in terms of human development growth, poverty reduction. And these benefits are in terms of economic, of incomes, livelihoods, economic benefits, services of all kinds being more available, mobile banking and financial services being one example that comes out quite strongly. Also in terms of social benefits, the ability to communicate, political, the ability to organize, some of the missing dimensions that Amartya's colleagues have emphasized: empowerment, security, dignity. So a kind of a range of benefits that include all of the areas of functionings, capabilities, and freedoms that Amartya and others have written about. There's also, I think, a strong sense that these benefits don't come automatically, and that a number of other conditions, factors have to be there. I think Inike's Bahati story is a very good example of that, what it takes to be able to take advantage, full advantage of the ability to communicate and the access to knowledge transfer that Mike spoke about. So most of you have been, in some sense, advocating a more holistic approach to ICT and development than was the case 6 years ago. And it that takes many different, there are many parts of that, and I'm just going to mention a few that some of you have emphasized: inclusion, openness, institutional emphasis, capacity building, awareness, and other aspects of human development, reform of the state, integration of ICT initiatives into other development strategies and projects, citizenship and communitization approaches, community action. So there are many lenses and many paradigms, and I guess the question that came out in our minds as we were reading this is, you know, what's most important? what kind of approaches are most productive and important, or perhaps are they all important and they can all work together? Is there a point in trying to bring agreement amongst many different approaches, or is it in fact a process of many people taking many approaches and arriving at a better conclusion? Finally, very briefly, many of you wrote about human development and some of the excerpts have been fed back to you. I guess the questions that came out in our minds there in some sense relate to what I just said, a question of to what extent are ICTs a kind of basic or platform technology, or put another way, to what extent are the communication and knowledge access important in enabling or assisting human development, enabling, assisting people to increase their functionings, capabilities, freedoms? Or on the other hand, to what extent do people need certain levels of capabilities in order to take advantage of the potential of the ICTs? So there's a little bit of a kind of chicken and egg question here. And a kind of corollary question is, to what extent, given the kind of very large externalities in networks that people like Michael Spence have spoken about, to what extent is communication, in particular something like education, a kind of basic building block of human development? And finally, many of you have mentioned, and we need to keep in mind, I think, some of the negative effects and potentials of ICT development, particularly in terms of control and repression, social mobilization for destructive purposes, privacy invasion, cybercrime, and kind of national vulnerabilities. So I think Amartya raised that at the start. We need to be not panglossy and think about what needs to be done to avoid, minimize these kinds of impacts. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thanks, Randy. Randy sort of summarized in three broad heads what has changed, potential and actual benefits from access, and then the connection with the larger issue of human development. If at least for this session, if we could stick to that taxonomy, might we have a discussion on one or more of those three aspects and things to add to what Randy and, in fact, the opening remarks have pointed out already is the task ahead of us for the day and a half?
I'll just amplify that. It's quite clear that we discussed this in the previous forum. You have a kind of platform, a basic capability, but what affects people's lives is sort of A, access to it, and B, a set of capability services. And what a number of you have said is that there are, as I read through the things, there are real obstacles, regulatory complexity, in getting things that really matter to people delivered to them. So I thought, under the heading of realizing the benefits, it would be useful as part of the discussion to hear a little bit more about, well, what is actually getting in the way of the... We used to call these applications. I mean, it's the things with functionality that people actually use. They use the network, but that's because it's sitting on the bottom somewhere.
Bill?
I'd like to follow up on a point raised by Mike and get the reaction particularly of him and possibly others. I just came from a preparatory meeting for the APEC, Asia-Pacific Economic Council, for those of you not in the business, a preparatory meeting to deal with ICT issues for the future. And the whole idea is that this discussion would be around possible policy regulatory changes among the APEC countries that I thought would liberalize markets in ways that would benefit developing countries. What became evident in the discussions was that the protectionist logic has come back into play, as we have read about it in the press. And in particular, protectionist logic in the U.S. with regard to intellectual property rights. And I think the research has shown, long before the financial crash, that the expansive view of intellectual property right protection was going beyond the pale. It was having negative effects, and in particular in developing countries. And that if the existing intellectual property rights are simply maintained, it's going to make economic growth in developing countries extremely difficult, particularly in the learning, knowledge creation industries. And what we're seeing now is that is becoming a very difficult issue, and that we seem to be moving backwards on that. That's an issue that not many of us addressed in our written comments, but it may be even more significant than the issues we've addressed, because if we don't make some headway on that issue, then all content in terms of its availability and access in developing countries is going to be extremely more difficult to access. I would put that out for... I hope someone has an answer to that question.
Well, this is actually something that I was wanted to focus on, partly... partly as a description of looking at what I focused on in my writing here as opposed to other things, partly reading Ronaldo, who's been working so much on Creative Commons and on commons-based practices and open business models, and yet writes here about a particular way of delivering devices, or Ethan, who's sitting there converting everything that we're doing into a text that can then be accessed by relatively low cost techniques without high bandwidth, but at the same time only when it's embedded in a particular organization and social set of expectations about listening in and then disseminating and translating into multiple languages. And there's some overlap between people in this room and people in the access to knowledge movement, which comes much more out of the access to medicines and access to food security-related research and access to patents, but not much. It's only very small. But this point about knowledge and knowledge diffusion and its constraints being absolutely central, I think, is very important. Part of it is IP. Part of it is, I think, habits of learning and capabilities to learn. So the point about having the computer open 24 hours a day, you still need to be at the university. And the question is, how do you get to a point where it's okay to try and you're capable of trying because you have the device, but at the same time it's okay socially to try and make mistakes and experiment, and where innovation comes from in terms of people trying at the edges and being able. So Bill, your point about openness and shifting from mobile to open wireless similarly strikes me as in the same dimension. I think this to be focused. The focus on ICT4D very much focused us on the materiel and on the business models for delivering it in a large scale model. And opening up the conversation to what are the flows of knowledge and the social structures and the organizational structures that allow all sorts of people to understand themselves as in the business of innovating and learning and teaching each other strikes me as a very important path. And one, it means, I think, to introduce patents and copyrights into the debate as on a co-equal basis. And another needs to be to try to see how ICTs and knowledge are embedded in social structures for control of what's allowed to do, what one is allowed to do and what one isn't allowed to do, and the extent to which, when they're actually brought into a place, devices or centers end up being embedded in a structure that says you can or you can't do. And the last thing I'd like to put on the table is the point that comes out of Lawrence's piece, which is the definition of goals. What counts as success of a program? And whether it's just about something that can be measured in terms of growth, or whether the focus, and I hope I'm not misstating, or whether the focus is every much about poetry by French ironworkers as poetry.
Well, just briefly, I agree with, it does fascinate set of comments. I imagine on a relatively short list of potential barriers is the excessive pursuit of intellectual property right protection, you know, between the places where it's being developed and the, it's on a short list of things that's tripped up the WTO negotiations, which are stalled. And what I think might be useful is to try to focus on practical solutions to this. You know, for example, you could go down the route of saying a reasonable compromise is protection of some of these property rights with a willingness on the part of the owners to you know, engage in 2-3-4-part pricing systems, plus a commitment, say, from international organizations to subsidize the acquisition of some of these things. I just made that up, but I mean, I think we have a practical problem to solve, and I think that's probably the right way to think about it. But it's important.
Not on intellectual property, but addressing Mike's question, what is getting in the way of the applications? Just like to talk about a country that we don't work in, and I don't want to give any heart attacks to IDFC, Myanmar. If you think about Myanmar, I mean, when you think about applications in Myanmar, it's a country of over 50 million people, and it has got 375,000 odd mobile phones. Compared to, so for example, if you take the universal comparator, which is how many active SIMs per 100 people, Bangladesh, which has got 27.9, and Myanmar has got 0.76. And it is one country where the mobile penetration is still less than the fixed penetration. Fixed is 1.44. So when we think about Myanmar, I think we just want to flag this, because Alison and I were talking about this, the interest in intellectual property yesterday. And while we at LearnAsia are beginning to move into intellectual property after a long, long time, we think that we should not forget the basics. Because without the basics, without electronic connectivity of some form, I still recall somebody telling me after that very devastating cyclone, because we had been working on early warning issues, saying, Rohan, now, you know, Bay of Bengal, why don't you do something? And I said, I have no idea what to do in Myanmar, because there's no platform that I can work with. All the work that we have done on cell broadcasting and so on and so forth just is irrelevant in a place which, on one side, the basic infrastructure doesn't exist, and on the other side is sort of like the horrible scenario that Mike talked about, a country where there is a lot of infrastructure, but really the knowledge infrastructure is destroyed. There's really, I mean, I've tried to work with people from Myanmar. It's going to be a real challenge when that country opens up. So I think in both those areas, I think that learning culture, the ability to gain knowledge, the ability to work with sophisticated ideas on one side, and the electronic connectivity platform, I think is going to, are issues that we need to think about, not only with regard to
Myanmar. I'm just using it as my extreme example. I mean, I've got one more, which is North Korea in my list, which is sort of the worst of the lot. These are the two lowest mobile penetration countries in the entire world. The others are Eritrea, Ethiopia, Cuba, Papua New Guinea, and Turkmenistan. These are the bottom dwellers in terms of electronic connectivity.
David, then answer.
One set of people we haven't talked about a lot this morning, but who are actually quite important, are politicians. And politicians have seen, in my country at least, an opportunity to save money by pretending that ICTs can deliver results they can't. A concrete example, about 12 years ago, Canada became serious about the Arctic circumpolar cooperation and so on, and the idea surfaced of having a University of the North. But given the population dispersion over a vast area, very limited population in Canada, in Norway, and other countries of the North, Russia for that matter, the idea of delivering the education by electronic means, distance learning, so to speak, was extremely attractive, especially as politicians imagined it was going to be very cheap. In fact, the first time it was raised with me, the minister responsible said, well, surely it won't cost more than $5 or $10 million, and we can announce a University of the North. So I think in some ways, ICTs and their potential are, and with the best of intentions, these weren't evil people, misunderstood at the political level as providing shortcuts. And it rejoins something Amartya was saying about schools and the need for actual human contact, interaction, and so on. The second thing I wanted to say was, when I was in India, one of my greatest pleasures as I traveled around, and I tried to travel a lot, was going to local universities and speaking about something or other and seeing what people thought. And in, you know, second tier or third tier universities, you rapidly realize that a lot of the faculty hadn't had a new thought since their graduate studies. But the students were incredibly keen, smart, wanting to learn, desperate to learn, in fact, and turning to the internet. That's what they were doing to try to learn. But there they ran into a real problem, organization of knowledge on the internet. For those without much knowledge to begin with, to try to find your way on the internet to the quality material is very, very difficult. For those of us with a bit of knowledge of a field to begin with, the internet's tremendously useful because we can go right to what we need. But actually out there, one of my discoveries in remote corners of the country was these wonderful students didn't have quite enough knowledge to get at what they wanted to know on the internet. So I think there's a big challenge there, and it came out in a number of the contributions, the written contributions to the meeting. But I suspect it's a really big challenge in the next 5 or 10 years ahead.
Alice.
I just wanted to pick up on a few things that Bill and Rohan had said, and also from our discussions around IP with Dursi as well. And it's just really just to flag them, because I guess some of the concerns are around expressing current failures that we see simply in terms of good governance failure and lack of individual capability. But Randy did flag that some of us were saying that, you know, the issues of the state needed to be raised again and addressed more closely. But I think in relation to, to Bill's point around the return of certain protectionism, certainly in Africa, particularly in relation to finding the necessary investment in broadband infrastructure, there's been a strong, many states have only seen that, you know, they're provisioning that themselves as the only solution, that there hasn't been adequate private investment or it hasn't been allowed. But anyway, there certainly is a greater concentration and a return to state ownership, which is not in and of itself bad. It's just that it does raise some of the issues around competition, monopoly provisioning, and some of the failures that we've seen in many of these jurisdictions sort of not being resolved. So I guess one of the things that I wanted to flag was to say that we've identified that there's not been an adequate implementation of reform policies. We can say that certain countries that have done certain things around privatization or liberalization or et cetera have achieved certain things. We know that all those countries know about these solutions. We know that in many countries they've rhetorically committed themselves to it. But yet they haven't really liberalized markets or created independent regulators or done a lot of the necessary things for successful reform. And what I think our researchers really failed to look at is why that is so. If the economic solutions are so obvious, and there's lots of evidence of success, why are so many developing countries not implementing those reforms? And I think what is really required there is a really more, a closer examination, a lot more research on the changing nature of the state, not in that very dichotomous state market kind of discussions that were had in the 90s and early 2000s, but something that resurrects the significance of the state in actually making some of these reforms happen. When Rohan speaks about there not being a platform, that in fact where the state is so dysfunctional, the market cannot work, the reforms cannot happen. And I think that research, particularly in relation to ICT, I think that research on the state has been done in a lot of other areas, and I think there is academic work on the state and ICTs, obviously. But I don't think it's really coming through in the kind of applied research and policy work that many of us are working in and doing. So I just wanted to flag that because I think the focus on capabilities in the papers tends to be on individual capabilities, on ensuring that individuals will have access outside of universities, and all of those things are important. The connectivity is absolutely critical if you're going to talk e-health or e-education or anything else. The connectivity is absolutely critical. But the discussions around intellectual property, internet governance, and that are kind of, why are we talking about internet governance if we don't have internet? If we have less than 1% home connectivity on the continent, can we have the discussion on internet governance if there is no internet to govern? So some of those sort of necessary steps have to be had there. And just to say finally that I think the issue of IP and that sort of thing, it's as if governments in Africa want to prioritize that. They're saying, we don't have internet, don't talk to us about intellectual property. On the other hand, unless they engage in those debates now, like the WTO and those other agreements, if they wait to have them, it's all going to be locked up and decided. So they have to engage in them. And it's a lot for any developing country to deal with, and certainly for us to research. But I think those kind of necessary components of the research are important to do concurrently without them having to all be in a knowledge to access basket or an IP in sort of higher level kind of area of research and discussion.
Herman?
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on Alison, also on David's comment, and because I think it's a very, very valuable discussion to try to put the IP law question in respect to all the other questions that have been raised in the papers. And I want to bring back a distinction that may be old-fashioned, but it's, I think, useful between tacit and codified knowledge. And what, obviously, IP addresses is the terms of access to codified knowledge. And I was thinking of your interesting question of what the sort of universal amnesia. Well, the amnesia might be of what things that are the codified, but if I still have the capability to relearn what of this knowledge, then I might well prefer that to the destruction of a physical capital. My point being, I think And this follows on David's comment as well, on what are the minimal threshold of knowledge that makes the other knowledge useful. I think that we have to put the IP law or the IP questions in perspective in developing countries, both in terms of societies with very unequal distribution of capabilities to use the knowledge, very unequal distribution of physical access and infrastructure access, and also, to be honest, how much does it really matter on the ground? And Ronaldo and others have looked into this, but I think there's an interesting question of how much does IP law really matters on a day-to-day basis to university and professors? How much does it matter to companies? And my sense is it may matter less than we think. We did a small research project on innovation and SMEs, and we ask about how does IP patents and software patents and so on matter to you. This was mostly in the software business, and most said, we don't care. Our business model is not based on anything that has to do with patenting and copyright and so on. And so my sense is, I just want to bring this to the table of if we start the distinction between what's tacit and what's codified and what IP really does is address a fairly small, or not small, but a specific set of knowledge issues. And I think it will be important to address what are the minimal conditions upon which you need to build in a society that after that, the access to knowledge starts really mattering. I mean, our developing countries have reached the threshold in which if you then open up access to knowledge, that will really make a transformative impact on the societies.
Ophelia, then Michael.
Yeah, I want to say that, and this is just from our area, the impression given is that you need access to internet or knowledge that has been developed from outside, so that the countries then begin to think that they don't have a role to play in this. I think it's very important to develop a culture of beginning your own kind of knowledge systems, of developing your own content, which is relevant to the country itself. So the way I see it when I talk to people, they always think in terms of access to knowledge from outside markets, outside information, outside health kind of solutions. But what about knowledge that is built within the country itself? And unless we get the countries to build a tradition, a culture of developing their own knowledge, of developing their own systems, they will always depend, there'll be a dependency on the outside world and not enough energy spent or enough attention given to own knowledge, to knowledge that is within the country, that should be preserved, that should be developed, which is more relevant. I don't know if I'm making a sense, but it's the outside world that seems to be very attractive. So that, we then become passive people. We're always thinking of how do we get access to this knowledge and how do we get access to that knowledge and how do we use the internet and so on. But what about our own knowledge? I think we are beginning to lose the tradition of building our own knowledge because we think we can go on the internet and get a solution to everything. Thank you.
Yeah. Michael.
Thank you. And actually, Alison and Hernan, I think, teed up my comments well, and I'm going to add strike a bit of a modest counter note to some of the comments on content and the property rights that surround that content. And that is to say that it may be putting aside the real issue, especially when we think of bottom of the pyramid users, which is not content but communication, in particular interpersonal communication. And so the intellectual property rights that might sit around this communication would be very different than how we would conceptualize it for content more broadly considered. So, for instance, in work that Colin McClay and I collaborated on in Tamil Nadu, rural internet users used Skype or Yahoo messaging services two to four times more than the next most popular application. They were communicating with their friends, their business associates, vegetable sellers were communicating with their supply chains and so forth. Many of us will know of fisher folk in Kerala and their communications to discover the best markets as they land their ships onto the coasts of Kerala. Again, interpersonal communication. Chris Coward and I are working now on surveys of internet users in cyber cafes in Ghana, where email is the number one application. Again, it's a form of interpersonal communication. So what I want to do is remind us that actually, especially when we look at the grassroots users of these technologies, that communication is the number one activity, not content access and retrieval, and that contemplating how intellectual property surrounds those forms of interpersonal communications, how regulatory regimes and governments respond to that activity also should be critical in our discussions.
Great. Amar, to you.
So many interesting questions coming up. I thought I'll comment on a few things and raise a few questions which I haven't got a clear understanding of, but would like to have that. I think there was one question that you were raising about local knowledge and thing. And it's actually a big debate and has gone on in development for a very long time. And I sometimes wonder whether we place the question in the right way in thinking of it, this kind of a bit of a contrast between the local and the global. Because the way these technologies have been absorbed hadn't tended to give the impression to people that this is something completely alien against our culture and so on. Wouldn't be able to explain the success of mobile phones in Bangladesh or anything else on that basis. It has tended to be, what can we do with this technology that's available? And I think it's an important question. We have been all involved in following the UNESCO's election, which results were announced this morning, with the Bulgarian lady getting it. But UNESCO had gone through that debate. There was a time when there was an attempt to keep out global culture and to emphasize local culture. I think the result was quite disastrous. That's not what you're arguing for. But what you are arguing for, I think the right way of accommodating it is not in terms of what can we do on the basis of our own culture unaided. Because we don't have any unaided culture. You know, maybe a lot of the work that is farmed out to India and China maybe just mechanical, but some of it is not. Quite a lot of the problem. I know I met the man at a party in Bombay who did for Ken Livingston, the calculation of what would happen to London if you impose the restriction on entering that. It's a very complicated mathing problem. It was given to them and they solved it. So I think it has become an interactive culture. And I think the message I'll take from your thing is how we can make people more functionally involved in not just their own thing, but anything else. But let me also mention that how the impact of this these influences have often been far more than we could anticipate. I mean, there is the difficulty issue, there's the authoritarianism issue, and all the other issues that we have been discussing and some of the papers bring out. But there's also the question of unexpected success, and let me talk about two of them. One is a completely political issue, and this concerns Swat Valley in Pakistan. And if you followed how the whole thing proceeded, there was a great peculiarity in general when there was a deal made with the Taliban in Swat Valley. There wasn't a kind of general opposition in Pakistan. You know, it's a slightly distant place, not threatening many of us here. And okay, well, they have these culture and so forth. generally there was a kind of apathy on that. I think if the change came about, and it eventually, of course, involved a change in the Pakistan government position as well as that of the military, but originally it was a contribution of the Pakistan Human Rights Commission, which is, unlike in India, it's not only recognized. Indian Civil Rights Human Rights Commission is a legally recognized body. So is South Africa's Human Rights Commission. Pakistan is not. It's simply an NGO. There's nothing. There's nothing to protect them other than what they can do by mobilizing public opinion, which they have done. The newspapers played a big part, and I want to come back to the newspapers in a few, a bit later. But what happened was that you may recollect, there was a young girl who was whipped, who was caned for having done something. I've forgotten what it is that she has done. But it was one of the activists who actually, on her telephone, shot that. And then it came out, and I think the Human Rights Commission initially denied that they were involved in it, mainly because they were under great threat. And indeed, my friend Azma Jahangir, who was the chair of the Human Rights Commission, received a death threat, and she's still under that whenever she travels. She has to be very careful because she is in a list to be killed. Anyway, what happened with the help of the Human Rights Commission, it went on to the television like Geo and so on, and then to the newspapers like Dawn. And then by the end of the month, and since I follow, I tend to read about three Pakistani papers to see what's going on there, and it's nothing as important for a place I go to often, namely India, as having a kind of situation which is not as threatening as it is. And by the end of the month, the public opinion was very moved. It's no longer the case that they thought that there was no problem in Swat. They thought it was disgusting what was happening in Swat. Now, this is something which I don't doubt that the PPP government would have wanted to, PPP-run by government, would have probably wanted to do anyway. But they were not in a position to do it until the public opinion came along. And I think the catalyst for all that was a camera inside a telephone which happened to take some primitive photographs and which was then absolutely in every television and every newspaper. So I think the many of the successes and the roles that it would play would be something which we wouldn't predict and we wouldn't fully understand. We can explain it, and it's good to explain it to understand what's going on. But it raises immediately also the question as to why does it work somewhere and not happen elsewhere? Now, in case of Africa, since one of my friends, namely Mo Ibrahim, who's been very involved in the internet, telephone thing, he's a Sudanese, and a successful entrepreneur, quite a visionary thinker, and has a lot of plans about changing Africa. And you might have seen in the papers that he also has started this prize, whereby each year they give a $5 million prize to someone with leadership thing. And that goes in your direction, David, about the political leadership question. And he came out to your conclusion. He sounded almost exactly like what you sounded before when I talked with him first on that, saying that he came out to the view that nothing would happen until the political leadership changed. But while nothing has happened, it's true at a very big level. The fact is the penetration in Africa that Mo's telephones made was just incredible. I mean, the fact that they can play $5 million prize every year is itself an indication of how profitable the business has been. So again, it was a success that wasn't entirely predicted, and I asked Mo, were you surprised? And he said, yes, astonished by the speed with which it spread. And I think that raises the question, which was a really exciting question, about Burma. Now, North Korea is quite different. But North Korea we know, because we've seen this kind of regime before. And, and I don't expect that there's going to be any kind of change. I mean, you couldn't have had in North Korea the monks' agitation in Burma at all, because that would have been, shot out at the initial end. North Korea raises a very different question, which is not the same thing as in the mind of the United States, namely how to contain its nuclear bomb. That's an important issue too. But also there's an issue about what the North Korea, what does it do for the North Korean? No one seems to be very concerned with this now, at this time, with the exception of some South Koreans on that subject. But Burma is an interesting question because it's in many ways the most prepared country for the Internet revolution. I grew up as a child in Burma because my father was a visiting professor in Mandalay until my age of 6. So my earliest schooling was there. But one of the striking things was how much more literate the country was. And it wasn't true only in the 20th century, it's true in the 19th, and I've gone back 18th, 17th, 16th, 15th century. And in fact, Burma was the most literate country in Asia, and the only competitor close to it was Thailand. India was nowhere near. Indonesia, I'm afraid, was nowhere near either. Malaysia was nowhere near. And I think it's not entirely unconnected with Buddhism and the fact that you're supposed to read the scriptures and have something. But whatever the cultural influences are on that, the fact is that they had that base, and they still have a high level, fairly high level of literacy. And that applies even to the rebels, the Karens and the others fighting in the borders. And despite that, the regime has been successful in keeping. And the regime, I mean, answer to partly your question, as I understand it, I'm mainly involved in the human rights angle in Burma, but what we get from Human Rights Watch and others is that it is very difficult to survive. They're not the same type as North Korea, but it's not the same type as China either, where basically it's tolerant, excepting when the regime feels very threatened. And the regime is not opposed to a lot of public discussion going on, as long as it doesn't ask questions about the hegemony of the Communist Party and a few sacred cows, which are not going to touch. Barring that, Burma is not that. There's any kind of thing. Monks using internet, telephone, would get into great difficulty. The communication problems are very tough. So I think what you were thinking of, what can you try? And of course, you know, you may go on trying. Of course, as you know, the human rights community is quite divided as to whether you should try to do anything or you wait for a change in Burma. What would face? There's one group of people who would argue what would bring about change most rapidly. And the other is to say, well, it's not going to happen rapidly. Aung San Suu Kyi had been in jail for a decade and will continue to be in jail and probably die in jail. And if that's the case, then what is it that what we can do? How can we change things? This is the question that you are asking. I think these are very big issues. And, you know, they're not, I'm not suggesting that IDRC solves them. But somehow we have to get into these questions, which are ill-defined questions, and which are of really profound importance to the world. And, you know, the Burmese, of course, are having a... I don't call it Myanmar, but that's mainly my political prejudice. It's always been called Burma anyway. There's a kind of deep division on thinking about on Burma about the one school would be that if you are more successful with internet penetration with mobile phone, then also the regime would be to that extent undermined. But then again, the dialectical argument is the regime knows it, and they won't let you do just that. So it's one of those Sherlock Holmes Moriarty problem. That yes, indeed, that I would get off on the train, but then again, Moriarty would know that, and so forth. So I think that I'm not suggesting that we unleash our full rigor of game theory into the story, but there are aspects of these things. Now I don't quite know. I mean, I'm a great believer in, just as I'm a great believer in local global interaction. I'm a great believer that a lot of work which don't really formally come up to standards that will give you tenure in Harvard, but which really make a major difference to the world. And I mean, like, I know Randy have been associated with the Oxford Opie Center. They do a lot of work of that kind, and which are not, you know, if you place it with one of my econometrician colleagues in Letaua, I think a lot of them, there could be holes punched in that because the data isn't quite as good. You can't, your testing may not be right. You might have assumed Gaussian distribution where you ought to look at the third moment, and so on. All kinds of questions that can come up. But I think we have to really think of this as a gigantic field in which there will be some very specific issues, of which the papers were excellent example how to study, as well as a recognition that there are bigger issues, not necessarily always bigger, but there are other issues, some of which are bigger, which would be approached probably in a much more informal way. And I don't think we want to... We want to do what we can to encourage that. It's true in my, not that I'm kind of been teaching for more than a half a century. In my students, some of them did extremely formal work, and their theorems are well known in the world, and there are others who did extraordinarily informal work, and yet made a major impact. So I think it's that duality which I wanted to emphasize. Sorry, it took a long time.
I have Ronaldo and Yohai who've been patient. I suggest that we go to the two of them. And Randy, we come back to you to wrap up the session at the end and finish in about 5 minutes if we can.
Anita.
And Anita. Okay.
I'm fine. I'm saving my presentation.
You can
save.
Thank you. Yohai.
That makes me very self-conscious, but I'll say it anyway. Because I think there's been a little bit of talking past, particularly with regard to the IP, and I just want to try to clarify. So the question is where learning happens and how learning happens. So if you think, for example, about local knowledge versus learning across borders, and you connect it to IP, the problem isn't, Hernan, finding that the SMEs in software don't care about IP, and therefore IP is less important. It's IP is important in the wrong way of what it's usually thought. It's not about getting money in some subsidized form to the rich economy companies so they can transfer. It's reducing and pushing back on the political pressure against IP so that a company that actually is a software services company in Argentina or in Brazil can compete equally with software services companies in North America on a contract, because they all come to a shared code base using free software, open source software. You know, I run Ubuntu is a African based distribution. That's what I run on my computer because it's better than many others, not for any other reason. But in order to do that, you have to accept that the production model is not a proprietary production model, that the problem of IP is as much one of resistance in the network as it is one of creating incentives and making sure, and that the political pressure is not about assuring some level of learning together with distribution. It's about where people are allowed to come to the state of the art and learn. That's one thing. And the second thing that goes, Mike, to your point about communication being the most important, there also it's a question of how both the network and the infrastructure is built in relation to these two questions. Do we think of creating investment incentives for carriers, in which case we think about building mobile networks, we think about making sure that they can manage the network, rather than the open wireless networks that Bill was talking about or that Ono Purbo was describing? Or do we think that basically, we were talking yesterday, Ethan, about how M-Pesa starts with people basically innovating, just reusing SMS, just basically sending SMS messages and inventing their own monetary transfer system, and then after the users innovate using a general purpose SMS service, the companies come along and stabilize it and put it as part of the carriage. So again, all of these questions, how you go, do you have Skype? Or do the suits against Kazaa, which is what developed the architecture of Skype, by the recording industry, because it starts out as a peer-to-peer music sharing service. And then the innovations of P2P discovery are the ones that get translated into Skype. It's the same company. It's the same founders. Does IP then say, no, you can't develop this technology because it can undermine the recording? So I think it's important to be able to talk the same language, and we come, I think, from somewhat different backgrounds about the assumptions of what's working and in which direction.
Anita. Yeah, I mean, I think what's been said in that degree of sophistication will probably escape me, but I think I'm coming a little bit from a kind of a normative philosophical understanding of those very things that have been commented upon. One is I do think that this dichotomy between infrastructure and access and you know, the governance architecture of that infrastructure is false. I think you can't have one, I mean, you can't create hierarchies between what's more important. And to that extent, I think the nature of access, the terms in which you have access are as important as access itself. The second, I think, is the way you worded it, Mike, is a bit essentialist, you know, that people seem to want communications more than content, and there I think we should turn to feminist literature. You know, it's like saying rural girls want to cook and clean much more than they want to go to school. So, and the argument can be that, you know, there are local schools, but still they refuse to go there, you know. So in some sense, there isn't a hierarchy between, you know, communications and knowledge. And I think these notions of demand, of individual choice, of need have to be problematized in the context of the cultures and the ecology and the institutional factors and parameters that one might want to create to make sure that you know, communications and knowledge are equally important to people who seek them.
Thank you. Randy, last word to you in this session.
Thank you. I'm not going to try to sum up or anything. I was going to make the same point as Mike, I think, that it's interesting to look whether there's a kind of separate idea about communication and information. We talk about ICTs as though information communication are the same thing. But it did seem to me, you know, throughout this process of writing a background paper, that there are a lot of benefits that come from simply from communication without much knowledge transfer. Those are, you know, sending an SMS message to transfer money from Doha to Manila doesn't involve much knowledge transfer. Getting a call in the morning to go to work doesn't involve much knowledge transfer. Calling a relative and being happy that they're okay doesn't involve much knowledge transfer. So I appreciate what people are saying, that there are relationships here that are more complex than I'm saying, and I think we should explore those. But it is interesting to me to think, and I tend to agree with Mike, that a lot of that benefit that comes very quickly at the bottom of the pyramid is from communication.
Great. Thank you very much. No.
You know, sorry. I was supposed to give you my reactions to all this, but I'll just give you my reaction to one. You know, I'm not surprised that the communications is, you know, a very large fraction of the bits. But I don't think there's an important policy issue associated with that. There's lots of reasons for that, and they're good reasons. You know, people like to communicate. They do get relevant real-time information that sometimes facilitates coordination of activity. You know, go to the right marketplace and stuff. Sometimes it's just doesn't have much to do with sort of economic stuff. But I've been struggling to try to figure out whether there's a policy issue associated with that. I think it's an interesting observation and there's a whole bunch of things that, you know, communication facilitates. You know, even the example Randy gave, transactions, you know. These are, you know, one of the, I mean, transactions aren't, they're slightly information intensive,
you know, in order to complete them. But, I mean, on a very short list of what's going on is the crushing of transaction costs associated with actually doing transactions. And I think everybody agrees that that's a tremendously important, you know, trend, if I can call it that. Money transfers, online banking, you know, on cell phone banking and stuff is, at the, I mean, in terms of access, this is really important. But my own personal view, unless somebody argues it, is that unlike the intellectual property sector, this is a sector that's doing just fine, you know, once people have access kind of on its own. I mean, I wouldn't, if I were sort of starting to write down a research agenda for, you know, a lot of what you all do, I would say clarifying issues related to intellectual property so people don't kind of think fuzzy about that would be a very high priority item. And kind of just to help people have a shared understanding of what's at issue and what's not really important. And I think on the communication side, things are going pretty well on their own.
Thank you. We've had sort of lots of food for thought, which we will sort of sift through in the coming day and a half. It strikes me already that, unlike 6 years ago, the types of questions on the table are in some cases quite radically different, and they have to do with taking ICTs as given rather than exploring sort of practical things like how might they be applied here and there. And there's much, much more of this broad-based. And the other thought that occurs to me is that, yes, there's a large global and regional sort of public good element to ICTs, but it might be different than our conventional approach to public goods, and we might want to come back to that one as well. I thought of that in the context of is Burma an impediment to a regional cyclone assessment system or not, but we can come back to that. Let's take a break for, I propose, 20 minutes, if we can not take a half hour, and come back at 5 after 11 and delve into some of the two-pagers with more in more detail. And Ronaldo, you'll have your chance to
okay.
open at that
Thanks.
Point. Thank you.
I like it already.
Well, sorry.